Coming up on Fronteras, researchers in New Mexico say treatment for a rare and often deadly genetic disorder may be found in the state's colonial history and descendants of Spanish conquistadors.
Up to 17 or 18 generations have now passed, we believe, since the gene entered New Mexico. So around the world, there are no other large clusters of families with an identical gene mutation.
Tackling the common Hispanic mutation through clinical studies and genealogy. Summer in Phoenix means triple-digit weather most days, but not everyone can keep up with the cost of air conditioning.
It was hot, and it was muggy in here. I just opened the windows up, you know, and let it be whatever it's going to be, you know. I couldn't do nothing else, you know.
Coming up, the struggle to stay cool in one of the country's hottest cities. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its Local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. One of the several dozen sacred items sold at auction in Paris last spring has been returned to the Hopi people. The tribe was vehemently opposed to the sale. From Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Back in April, when lawyer Pierre Servan Schreiber couldn't convince a French judge to stop a Paris auction house from selling 70 Hopi sacred items, he bought one to return to the tribe. He paid 6,000 euros, or about $7,800. Museum of Northern Arizona Director Robert Brunig says the ceremonial items are considered living beings, and they should have never been taken from the reservation in the first place.
Their word is Ikwatsi, my friend. It would be like selling maybe one of your children. And so they're taken care of as something that's alive. They're fed. They're loved. And you don't sell something you love in that way.
So to have one returned home means a lot to Hopi Chairman Leroy Singoitua, who says he felt disheartened by the sale. While he's grateful to have one back, Singoitua says the tribe couldn't ask anyone to buy the items for them.
If we were to ask someone to do that, we are showing disrespect for our sacred objects that were auctioned. The value to us in our mind is far more valuable than money can ever buy.
The family of the late French singer Joe Dawson bought a second kachina at the auction and plans to return it to the tribe later this year. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
In the Southwest, a rare genetic disorder known as the common Hispanic mutation has haunted those of Spanish descent for nearly 400 years. They call it el frío, or the cold. From our Fronteras desk, Tristan Otzon reports that for the first time, researchers are looking into the genealogy of the disease and are hoping for treatments.
Janae Jasmine Gallegos liked playing on the trampoline with her two brothers, biking, skating, and cheerleading. She was 9 when she died.
She had a cheeseburger at lunch the last day of school and just came home feeling fluish and having a headache and just seemed like a bad cheeseburger.
Tim Gallegos is her father. He and her mother, Sandra, live in Santa Fe.
She had had headaches before and they seemed pretty bad, but when we would give her Tylenol, her headaches would go away. In the morning when Tim got up, she wasn't responding and we knew something was really wrong.
Janae had a blood clot in her brainstem. The end result of the common Hispanic mutation, or cerebral cavernous malformation, CCM1 for short. The disease affects the way the body forms blood vessels in the brain and spinal cord, and is often misdiagnosed as a brain tumor, multiple sclerosis, or migraines. For many people, the disease never manifests, but for some, it's fatal. Dr. Leslie Morrison is director for the Cavernous Malformation Clinic at the University of New Mexico.
People used to call them brain tumors, and so we get way too many brain tumors in the family histories of patients who have this disease. Or they might say they were in a wheelchair and we never knew what caused it.
CCM1 was first recognized in the 1960s by University of New Mexico researchers who found familial connection, primarily in the state's Hispanic population. That familial connection has been documented in such places as the New England Journal of Medicine and the American Journal of Neuroradiology.
Probably more than 95% of our patients who have the familial form have a single gene mutation, identical in everyone called the common Hispanic mutation.
New Mexico's Hispanic population is unique. Their bloodlines aren't traced to Mexico. Instead, they descend from Spain's Hispanic conquistadors that colonized the region. Morrison suspects there are thousands of people in the state that have the disease, many of which are undiagnosed. And since the Southwest has the only known large cluster of this disease, Morrison says the likely reason is that CCM originated in the New World as a result of one Hispanic couple.
We have Juan Perez de Bustillo, and he was born in about approximately 1558. And then his wife was Maria de la Cruz, and she was born in about 1560.
Joyce Gonzalez is an amateur genealogist who, working with Morrison at UNM, began tracking CCM after she was diagnosed. Gonzalez says it's unknown whether Juan Perez de Bustillo or his wife had the mutation, and it's unclear if one of their parents had it.
But what we can be certain of is that whichever one of them had it was the first grandparent to bring it to New Mexico. And all of us here in New Mexico, Southern Colorado and Eastern Arizona, with the CCM1, all descend from that set pair of grandparents.
CCM1 doesn't skip generations. Only one parent can have it, and descendants have only a 50-50 chance of being born with it. So to map the disease, researchers navigate a sea of Spanish names and build some very complicated family trees. In Gonzalez's case, she can trace her lineage from Juan Perez de Bustillo's daughters.
One of them is Ana Perez de Bustillo. One is Beatriz Perez de Bustillo. If you take it all the way down, you'll come to me.
In the New Mexican Hispanic population, most can trace their ancestry back to just a few couples who helped colonize the Southwest. By identifying descendants and relatives who may have the disease, researchers like Dr. Leslie Morrison can gather patients to diagnose the disease and develop treatments. For the Gallegos in Santa Fe, this is very important. After losing their daughter, Janae, they say they now feel like they're racing to find help for their 11-year-old son, Joel, who has also been diagnosed with CCM.
It's just very hard living a life with a big question mark hanging over your head all the time.
Researchers in New Mexico have begun human trials of cholesterol drugs that could block the effects of the gene mutation. And New Mexico's congressional delegation has introduced legislation to expand research, education, and treatment efforts related to CCM. In Albuquerque, I'm Tristan Ottone.
An Arizona family tangled in a high-profile deportation case learned this week they can stay in the country. They are among a growing number of unauthorized immigrants in Maricopa County that the federal government is choosing not to deport. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, Jude Joffe Block explains the mounting tension between the federal government and local law enforcement.
4 years ago, Maricopa County Sheriff's Office deputies descended on a car wash and arrested about a dozen employees on felony charges for using fake IDs to work. Sandra and Carlos Figueroa were among them. At the time, their U.S. citizen daughter, Kathy, was 9.
I never thought this would happen to my parents.
That's Kathy on a YouTube video right after the arrest. She asked President Obama to help get her parents out of jail.
And I don't want Sheriff Joarpaio getting other people and my parents again.
To date, Joarpaio's office has arrested several hundred immigrants on identity theft charges for working with fraudulent papers and Social Security numbers. It's a tactic that's been criticized by the Department of Justice, which has sued Arpaio for discriminating against Latinos. For the Figueroas, they did eventually get out of jail after pleading guilty to a felony. Carlos says he and his wife used made-up Social Security numbers that didn't belong to anyone.
Obviously, I never used to try get benefits for myself. I never do that. I never took identity for anybody. I never took Social Security for anybody.
But Carlos and Sandra were felons under the law. Immigration and Customs Enforcement initiated deportation proceedings against the couple. Their criminal record meant they were ineligible for any immigration benefits and a priority for deportation.
Sí, teníamos el temor y teníamos muchas...
We had fear. We had a lot of anxiety, said Sandra, about the possibility of deportation. But now we can finally rest easy, she says. That's because this week, ICE decided to use prosecutorial discretion to close its deportation case against the Figueroas, which allows them to stay in the country. On Wednesday, an immigration judge made it official. Even the Figueroas' attorney, Delia Salvatierra, admits this was an unusual outcome.
It's amazing that this case was administratively closed because there's an underlining felony conviction.
In recent months, local attorneys and activists, including Salvatierra, have been persuading ICE lawyers to close dozens of deportation cases against immigrants who have felonies on their record because they use fake papers to work in Maricopa County. Salvatierra has argued it's a conflict for the federal government to take these felony convictions at face value.
How can one arm of the Department of Justice be suing and arguing that MCSO's conduct in these worksite raids is unconstitutional and a violation of civil rights?
While at the same time, the Immigration Court, which is also housed within the Department of Justice, deports those immigrants arrested by the sheriff. In May, a federal judge presiding over a different racial profiling suit against Arpaio found his office discriminated against Latinos. Salvatierra says she believes that verdict has made it easier to convince ICE to look at these identity theft felonies in Maricopa County differently.
I think that the trend and the growing sentiment is to really undermine those convictions that arise against Latinos and undocumented workers by the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office.
ICE would not comment beyond a statement saying it's focused on removing criminals and repeat offenders. Given that, Sheriff Arpaio says he thought it was strange that the Figueroas weren't deported.
Because I thought the felons were one of the priorities of the government to deport.
But he says it's ultimately the federal government's choice.
I'm going to continue to do my policy, which is enforce the fake ID laws.
In fact, the same day the Figueroa's deportation case was closed, sheriff's deputies swarmed two Phoenix-area restaurants and arrested nine workers on identity theft charges. Immigrant rights advocates said they believe the arrests were retaliation. The sheriff said it would be impossible to launch an operation that quickly and said the investigation began more than 9 months ago. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
There's still more Fronteras. Summer in Phoenix means triple-digit weather most days, but not everyone can keep up with the cost of air conditioning.
It was hot, and it was muggy in here. I just opened the windows up, you know, and let it be whatever it's going to be, you know. I couldn't do nothing else, you know.
The struggle to stay cool in one of the country's hottest cities. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Phoenix would never have boomed into a sprawling metro area of more than 4 million people if it weren't for air conditioning. It's over 100 degrees there, almost a third of the year, and air conditioning allows the region to function. But as the temperatures soar, so does the cost of cooling. Jude Joffe Block has this report on those who struggle with their bills.
At the end of June, temperatures were hitting record highs in Phoenix in the 100 teens, and 66-year-old Richard Abington was on the brink of losing power and his air conditioning.
Usually at the end of the month, that's when things get chaotic, you know, because I'm out of money. A lot of times I'm out of food.
Abington lives off disability, $730 a month. He's enrolled in a utilities program that lets him pay for his power as he uses it. It comes with a box that's about the size of a modem that sits on his kitchen counter. It tracks how much credit he has left on his account.
It'll go to beeping when you get low credit. It'll let you know.
At the end of last month, it began to beep. He had no money and everything shut off. The lights, the appliances, and the AC.
It was hot and it was muggy in here. I just opened the windows up, you know, and let it be whatever going to be. You know, I couldn't do nothing else, you know. I'm glad I didn't have no food in the fridge, because if I had, everything would have spoiled.
The next day, relatives loaned Abington money, and he got his electricity back immediately. The pay-as-you-go program is saving him from having his power service completely disconnected. Every weekday, on average, some 400 households that are delinquent on their bills are scheduled to have their power turned off by the state's two biggest utilities. That's usually a last resort. But when the AC does go out, it comes with health risks.
Heat deaths are the number one cause of death from weather-related issues in the United States.
Sharon Harlan is a sociologist at Arizona State University. Last year, more than 40% of the 100 heat-related deaths in Maricopa County happened indoors, according to the county health department.
In many of these cases, there is no air conditioning, or the air conditioning is not turned on.
A typical summer electricity bill here is $180 a month, and up to two-thirds of it can be due to air conditioning costs, according to Arizona Public Service, the state's biggest utility.
There are discount and charitable programs for needy customers, and every year the federal government puts aside money to help low-income people pay their energy bills, though those federal funds have been shrinking in recent years. Cynthia Zwick works on poverty issues with the nonprofit Arizona Community Action Association.
The need is great, and the resources to serve is not so great. So there's a huge gap in what actually the funding will support.
Last year, Arizona got $22 million in federal funds, which was enough to assist about 50,000 households with energy bills. But that's only a tiny fraction of the households in poverty here. The problem is the formula for allocating those energy assistance funds favors cold weather states over warm states. So Connecticut, a state with a smaller population than Arizona's, got more than three times the funding. Zwick is part of a network of advocates trying to change the formula.
All we're asking for is an equal distribution of those funds based on the numbers of people living in poverty, numbers of people unemployed, heating and cooling degree days.
Meanwhile, local offices are overwhelmed by requests for help. The city of Phoenix last year registered 120,000 calls, but could only help 1 in 10 with energy bills.
People start calling in. It's busy, it's busy, it's busy. They're calling over and over. It's kind of like when you're trying to win the radio contest. There are so many calls that often they don't get through.
This year, Richard Abington was one of the lucky ones who did get through. He was awarded more than $400 for his electricity bill.
Everything just opened up for me, you know, and I feel relieved. I don't have to worry about this electricity now, you know.
But with temperatures on the rise across the Southwest, the risk of losing AC may become more widespread. Sociologist Sharon Harlan.
The problems show up first in the vulnerable populations that have less access to the technology. But the problems will grow, and we can't ignore the fact that the system itself is at risk.
Many predict power outages will increase in the future, and that could affect all of us who depend on cool air for survival. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Jaffe Block.
100 years ago this month, Death Valley was the hottest place on Earth. The temperature on July 10, 1913 has never been topped. But some climate experts doubt the desert actually reached 134 degrees. For the Fronteras desk, KPBS science and technology reporter David Wagner went to Death Valley's Furnace Creek to find out why this record is so controversial.
On a summer day in Death Valley, 121 degrees Fahrenheit is nothing out of the ordinary. But the heat is still pretty unbearable for Alicia Chab, visiting from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Your feet start to burn if you're not wearing, like, actual, because I have flip-flops on and my feet feel like they're gonna fry.
If 121 is the point at which feet start to fry, imagine what 134 must feel like. That's reportedly how hot it got here a century ago. At least, that's what the record books say.
I would assume most people who are meteorologically oriented would not believe this record.
That's Christopher Burt.
I'm the weather historian for a website called Weather Underground.
And he's an authority on extreme heat. Last week, Burt joined a group of meteorology wonks in Furnace Creek to mark this unusual anniversary. In a way, he's the guy who made the gathering possible. That's because he helped to get the previous all-time heat record, held by a small Libyan town called Al-Azizia, thrown out, bestowing Death Valley with the honor of world's hottest place ever.
I thought, well, within the weather community, of course it'd be news, but I would never have thought that there'd be people walking around with T-shirts saying 134.
You can clearly see that the park prides itself on this centennial. But Burt and many of his peers think the commemorative T-shirts being sold at the visitor center are probably not accurate. In fact, a few of the more obsessive weather watchers out there told Burt he was betraying them just by showing up.
They thought by attending this, I was somehow confirming the record, you know, or participating in propagating this myth of this 134 degrees, which is, couldn't be further from the truth because I'm frankly a skeptic of it myself.
For Burt, one red flag about this record is that Death Valley has never even come close to matching 134 degrees since 1913. It hasn't even breached 130.
So it's way, way anomalous.
And the Death Valley weather station was alone in reporting such fiery temperatures that day. Nearby places were hot, but not that hot.
It was only 112 in Las Vegas, 115 in Blythe.
And what should we make of reports saying it was windy that day? That's a condition usually associated with cooler temperatures. Bert ultimately suspects something might have been wrong with the thermometer. Then why not overturn the Death Valley record, just like Bert and his colleagues did for Alazizia? Well, the World Meteorological Organization makes the call on overturning old records. And they're part of the United Nations, so you can imagine how long that process takes.
As I found out with the Azizia evaluation, it's very, very difficult to overturn these old records. They're innocent until proven guilty.
So for now, the Death Valley record stands. And it will keep being invoked by climate change deniers who love arguing that global warming isn't happening because, look, the globe's warmest moment happened long before Al Gore was even born. Bert says people who interpret old weather data this way are missing the point.
Individual records really don't mean much. That being said, if the world is getting warmer, then you expect the baseline to be rising and therefore more and more extreme heat temperatures occurring. And in fact, that does seem to be happening.
Last month, Death Valley set a new record for the hottest ever June temperature. The mercury peaked at 129.2 degrees Fahrenheit. That would tie a temperature taken in Tarat Zvi, Israel in 1942. And Israel had weird bookkeeping practices back then, so there's a chance their record wasn't actually that high. Which means Death Valley's most recent heat wave could have set a June record and broken all-time figures.
One could argue this is the hottest reliably measured temperature on Earth at this point.
So even if the 134-degree high were discredited, along with a bunch of other old records, Death Valley would still remain the all-time heat champion. The park wouldn't have to worry about a decline in tourism, but they might have to make new t-shirts. David Wagner, KPBS News.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.